Sounds weird when I describe it, but I'll tell you why I do it. Start of every class, you're going to have a test on what we're going to do during the class. Sounds backwards, right? I hope to illustrate two things, and I've done this for a long time. I hope to illustrate two things. One is that you already know the stuff that we're going to do, that much of this should be common sense, that you can reason your way through, so that when it comes, you think, oh my God, this is... And once in a while, you will find something that you think is intuitive that during the course of the class, we will counter. So both lessons are useful. So at the start of every class for the next 25 sessions, you're going to see a pre-class test. Okay? It's not going to be a big deal. It's not graded, obviously, but it's really to give you a sense of what's coming during that class. So one of the things I asked you to do yesterday was to make a judgment for yourself as to whether you're a stories person or a number person. And you really don't need to go through any tests. I mean, let's face it, you know, starting in about fifth or sixth grade, if you loved history, you're a strange person. But already your mind, with my four kids, I mean, my youngest is going through AP history right now, and he loves it. He said, what's wrong with you? Okay? But my other three kids, two hated it, and I mean, one liked it. So in a sense, you can already see that we're tilted towards one side or the other. We're more stories people or more numbers people. And when you come into evaluation class, you assume that the numbers people have the high ground, right? And they act like they do. We're the numbers people. We know how to do calculus. Big deal. So one of the things we're going to start off with today is to talk about how evaluation is about getting both sides of your brain going. So I'm not going to ask you to let me ask you to put up your hands. How many of you view yourselves more as numbers people than story people? Okay. How many of you view yourselves more as story people than numbers people? How many of you feel you're perfectly balanced? Both sides of your brain are optimally running. We wish, right? What we're going to do during this class is I'm going to draw on both of you because you're going to see both sides work out. So just file that away because what I'd like you to do is work on your weak side. You know what I mean? If you're a numbers person, I'd like you to think about making your story side stronger. I'm a natural numbers person. And this has been my struggle for 28 years is to get that story side going rather than tamp it down. So this is all about numbers. Stories are too subjective. But let that side kind of... And if you're a numbers person, I'd like you to start working... if you're a story person, I'd like you to start working on the numbers. Because if you can get some balance going, then you've essentially got valuation, at least the first step, nailed down. Now let's take the other side. This is the other... slide that I sent you. I don't know whether you got a chance to do it, but even if you didn't get a chance to do it, I'm going to take you through these scenarios. And here's what I'd like you to think about. Again, you don't need any valuation background to do this. You're going to play the role of somebody doing a valuation. I'm going to describe your role, and I want you to tell me, given your role, whether your bias is going to be to push the number up, push the value up, or push the value down. And you're going to see very quickly what I mean by this. Let's start with the first scenario. You have a business to value. You guys are going to be the entrepreneurs who've started, you've built up the business. You guys are going to be the venture capitalists, right? So you're coming to the venture capitalists to raise capital, 15 million, 20 million, 25 million. So if you're valuing your business for selling a portion, because that's what you're doing with the venture capitalists, do you want to come up with a high number or a low number for your company? You want a high number. And you as the venture capitalist, do you want to attach a low number or a high number to that company?
Low.
Low, because then you get a much bigger share, right? Now you think that's obvious. Let's see the vehicles we use to come up with those high or low numbers. Venture capital valuation is actually very simplistic. Not simple, simplistic. Because here's how you do it. You usually project out earnings or revenues or some number 3 or 5 years out. You apply a multiple to that number. So let's say it's earnings, 3 years out. You apply a price earnings ratio. God only knows where you come up with that number. And then once you come up with that number 3 years out, you bring it back to today using a target discount rate, a target rate of return, which again is a made up number. So you need an earnings 3 years out, you need a price-earnings ratio to attach to those earnings, and you need a discount rate to discount them back. So when you make those picks, let's start with the earnings number. Do you want a high number or a low number?
High number.
So you're going to come up with a high number. Oh, this business is incredible. Look at the potential market. You want to have a high PE ratio or low PE ratio? You want to get a higher. So you're going to pick those companies that give you the highest PE ratio, and then you want to discount it back as little as possible, so you want to come up with the lowest discount rate you can. Whereas you as a venture capitalist want to say, look, and I'm going to tamp down your earnings. I think you're being too unrealistic. I'm going to apply the PE ratio of these bigger companies in the sector. And then, of course, you pull out your trump card, which is what kind of target rates of returns do VCs require?
High.
Completely, totally, unrealistically high numbers, because they're made up numbers. And that's exactly why when VC said, this is my target rate of return. So it's nothing to do with the discount rate. This is game playing on your part to bring the value down, because that's effectively what you want to end up with is a much higher stake in the company. I'm not saying this is bad or good, immoral or unethical. It's the nature of the game, and it is a game. So that's the first scenario. Everybody comfortable? So the owners want the highest number. The VC wants the lowest number. Now let's try something different. Right? You're in court now. You're both appraisers, and it's a divorce. So you work for the spouse who owns the business. You're the spouse who's now splitting away, and you want half the business for yourself. So you hire appraisers to value the business. So you're working for the owner. In this case, you're the spouse who has to give away half of your business that you've come up with. You want to come up with a low number or a high number for the business? You're basically saying, this business is worth nothing. Half of nothing is nothing. Take nothing, right? And of course, you want to say, this is worth billions of dollars. I want half of those billions of dollars. Again, you can see that you come in with those priors. You're going to find a way to arrive at that number. And of course, you're going to make the valuation look like it's what gave you that number. Now let's play a different game. And this is played out time and time again. You're valuing a business for tax court. The tax guy wants 40% of the value of your business, his capital gain, whatever. Okay? So you're the appraiser for the owner. You're the appraiser for the IRS. No surprises here, right? You're the appraiser for the owner. You want to come up with as low a number as possible, and you want to come up with as high a number as possible. I remember about 20 years ago, the very first time in my life, I actually got up in front of a group of appraisers. And they gathered together in the thousands every year to talk about valuation. And I'd never really been in front of that kind of valuation group before. And I was supposed to talk for the first hour, and then after that there were a series of topics. And I looked at every topic, and every topic had the word discount in it. Liquidity discount, controlled discount, complex. I mean, basically the rest of the day was about discounting. He said, what are you guys so fixated about discounts with? And they gave me all these intellectual reasons. But you can see why appraisers like talking about discounts, right? Because what's your objective? It's to bring the number down for the tax guy as low as possible. And one way you get there is to come up with the value and then start discounting. Take off 25% for illiquidity. Take off another 20% for control. Take off another 15% for something else. Not surprisingly, the value you end up with is much lower than the value that the appraiser for the IRS comes up with. Let's keep going. You're a sell-side equity research analyst valuing a company with the intent of putting a recommendation on it. This is a tricky one, right? What do you think? Bias up, bias down? No bias. And if you worked in sell-side equity research, I might as well put you on the spot. You worked in sell-side equity research? Okay. So since you've done this, tell me. You biased up, biased down, no bias.
You're trying to, in the seller room, bias up?
You think it's bias up. It depends on who you think your customer base is, right? Who are you doing the research for? You know, if it's clients, portfolio managers, and you say, look, I don't want to get too biased up, because then if it's the companies that you're doing the equity research on, because they do other investment banking business with you, then so you can see that there's a weird mix of factors that play in, and you can tell a story about how the bias is going to be pushed up, and probably it's going to be net up because there are so many other businesses that this company is involved in. But in some cases, you can actually see what that you can have countervailing forces pushing you down, because you don't want to get too optimistic out there, because then your clients stop reading your equity research. So sell side equity research, and we'll come back and talk about this. It's not that there's no bias, but it's coming from lots of different places pushing you in different directions. Okay. Now let's go to M&A. The way I describe M&A is this is the graveyard where valuation first principles go to die. So if any of you work in M&A, get used to it. Okay? So now let's talk about why that happens. So you're going to have a friendly merger. What's the essence of a friendly merger? Everybody wants a deal to go through except for the one group we'll come back and talk about that might actually be paying for the deal, right? So you guys are going to be the investment bankers for the acquiring company. You guys are going to be the investment bankers for the target company. And you both want the deal to go through, right? It's a friendly merger because you collect deal fees from both. So what's when you value the target company, so basically you've got to show a valuation of the target company. Do you want to show a high number? Because you've got to convince your stockholders that this is a good acquisition, right? So you work for the acquiring company, so you want to come up with a high number or a low number for the target company? What's the problem? If you come up with a low number for the target company and you're actually paying more than that number, do you see what your stockholders are going to say? Well, you're paying too much. That's not. So basically, you've got to come up with a high number. And what do you have to come up with to convince your stockholders that this is, in fact, a good deal? You've got to come up with a low number to convince the world. So the same number is being paid, but you've got to convince your stockholders that they're getting a good deal. And you've got to convince your stockholders that they're also getting a good deal. How is this possible? Of course, you could have two sets of valuations, two different numbers. But you know what allows you to kind of span this? Because I've seen investment bankers actually be investment bankers for both sides of the transaction. I know it's considered unethical in some markets, but I've actually seen markets where the same investment banker actually works for both the acquiring and the target firm. I don't know how you manage this conflict of interest, but they seem to pull it off. You know how you span the difference? How do you convince the acquiring firm that they're getting a great deal and the target company stockholders? Use synergy. Do you see why that makes a difference? Because the target company stockholders, they're standalone. You can say, look, you get no synergy, but we combine. Look at the magic we've created. You then get that additional value. So not surprisingly in acquisition, synergy becomes that plug variable, not so much because it exists, but it allows you to play this game of convincing both sides that they're actually getting a good deal out of this process. Now let's talk about a little more messy scenario. Let's say you have a hostile acquisition. What's the essence of a hostile acquisition? The banker of the acquiring firm still wants a deal to, wants to convince his stockholders it's a good deal. But the banker for the target firm, because you've been hired by the managers for the target, want to convince the world that this is not a good deal. So let's start with you. You still have the same job you had when you had a friendly merger. You have to show that the target company is worth a lot. But you have to be, again, careful, because if you show it worth too much, then the bankers from the other side are going to use this as ammunition against you. So you got to have it tempered over valuation, right? Now, you got to convince your stockholders that they're paying too little. So your objective is to push up the value of the target company, saying, look, they're paying you too little. Fight this deal. There might be somebody better outside. Much trickier exercise, because you're talking about a hostile acquisition where one side wants the deal to go through, the other doesn't. You're a buy-side analyst. Does everybody know the difference between a sell-side equity research analyst and a buy-side equity research analyst? Somebody want to explain the difference? Sell-side equity research analysts do what? They work for investment banks. They follow 15 or 20 companies, usually within a sector. They put buyer-sell recommendations. And it's for not so much public consumption, but for selling. That's the sell part of it. Selling to portfolio managers and other investors out there as to what. No. Buy side analysts work for the portfolio. So you work for Fidelity or State Street or Barclays. So buy side analysts tend not so much to be focused in New York. They tend to be spread out all over. They value companies for internal consumption. You know what I mean by internal consumption? For Fidelity to decide what to buy, what to sell. So it's a different kind of game. Your research doesn't get publicized. It's actually for internal consumption. So you're a buy-side analyst. You're valuing your company for your portfolio manager. After all, you work for those guys who already happens to own 1 million shares of that stock. You think, so what? So you're the buy-side analyst. What are the two things you can find? There are three things you can find. Your stock is fairly valued, it's undervalued, or it's overvalued, right? Think of delivering this message to the portfolio manager. Which one is he going to be happiest to hear? He already owns 1 million shares of the company, right? People like confirmation. If you go to that portfolio manager and say, hey, this is a great buy, he says, that's exactly what I thought. You tell him it's overpriced, he has to face one of two challenges. One is he has to accept the fact that he's wrong and sell it, or he's more likely going to turn on you and say, you don't know what you're talking about. Go back and take another look at the numbers. If you're a buy-side analyst and you assess the value of a company for Bill Ackman and you tell him Herbalife is undervalued, you're not going to last very long because the guy's sold short on the stock. He's convinced it's the biggest fiasco on the face of the earth. What I'm trying to say here is, and this is something I'm going to start with today, is we think of valuation as an exercise in objective number crunching. And I want to start off first with this narrative versus story thing, and then I'm going to move on to how bias permeates valuation. You can't avoid it, and how what you see as output, the end result of a value, is more the result of what you came in with as your biases than any numbers that you crunched along the way. Okay? So when you get a chance, review them. I'll send you actually my, you know, the answers as I see them, but think through these biases, because they're, I think, the best way to think about why companies get valued the way. Okay, so let me move to page 5, which is where I left you. Let's start with this narratives versus numbers thing. I think one of the problems we face in investing and valuation is that people go into camps. We have the numbers people and we have the story people, and never the two shall meet. Okay? I hate to kind of put terms on these, but think of the numbers people as people who love to work with spreadsheets. They love to work with numbers. They love to model. They love to come up with values for companies based on the numbers. And then you have the story people who love to tell you business plans and ideas and stories, and they're very creative about it. So in fact, when you talk to venture capitalists are usually not numbers people, they're story people. They're telling a big story about the company. The numbers are, in a sense, the afterthought. Whereas the numbers people work with Excel spreadsheet and come up with numbers. And I think there are dangers in both extremes. If you're a pure numbers person, you have no story behind your valuation, then the numbers basically drive your valuation. There's no consistency. There's nothing holding your valuation together. On the other hand, if you're just a story person and you never talk about numbers, it's very easy to cross that line between a reasonable story and fantasy land. So one thing we're going to do repeatedly through this class is talk about how your narrative matches up to your numbers. Let me give you an example. Now, how many? I think I saw about a dozen of you have done valuations of Alibaba already. You have a couple of days. Give it your best shot, because as I said, this is one of those cases where you can get confirmation or not from what the market actually does. If you think about the narrative, the story I'm telling about Alibaba, this is the story I'm saying. In my story, Alibaba is a company that dominates the Chinese online merchandising market, and I expect it to continue to dominate that market for the foreseeable future. The way it shows up in my numbers, the domination shows up in the market share. The fact that it's a merchandising company shows up in the margins that I'm using. And the fact that it's Chinese shows up in the growth rate that I'm using. So essentially, my growth rate, my market share, my margins reflect my narrative. Saying, so what? Let's say your narrative is different. It's more optimistic. You think of Alibaba not as a company that just dominates Chinese online merchandising, but as a global online company. See how your valuation could be different? Your potential market now is not just the Chinese market, it's the global market. Your potential business is not just merchandising, it could be retailing, it could be social media. So your margins will be different, your revenues will be different, your growth rates will be different, your value will be different. Which one of us is right? You can't make a judgment till later. But for the moment, here's all you can do is have a narrative that you've tested against common sense. Is that possible? Then have the numbers that match up the narrative and a valuation that emerges from it. For the moment, if you've never done valuations, how the hell do we do that? But as we do this with company after company, hopefully it'll start to become second nature. That when you think about a valuation, you start with the narrative first, you test the narrative out, and then you end up with a valuation that kind of matches that narrative. That's where I said you got to work on your weak spots. Those of you who are narratives people, the first part will be easy. The last part will be like pulling teeth when you first start doing it. For those of you numbers people, the last part will be easy, but coming up with a narrative and telling a story will go against every fiber of your being. You say, "I don't want to do that. Just let me be with the numbers." Okay? But I think, again, that's the key to valuation is if you can navigate both sides, because there are very few people who can talk to both sides. What I mean by that is there are very few people who can talk to venture capitalists at the level of narrative and then talk to a banker at the level of numbers and actually see if they're talking about the same thing. I've been in rooms where there's a venture capitalist in the room and there's a banker in the room. The banker turns out a valuation. The venture capitalist tells a story. They think they're talking about the same company, but then I look at the valuation of the story and they don't match up. And that's when you get into serious trouble. So I'll send you a few links because over the summer I got into this extended debate about Uber, about what the value of Uber is. So I did a valuation on 538. I don't know how it ended up on 538. It got picked up from my blog. 538, for those of you, is Nate Silver's website, where essentially he's a pure numbers person. So he said, "Can you take me through?" And for some reason, Bill Gurley, who's venture capitalist, lead venture capitalist, or one, and a director at Uber, decided that he felt that this was an unfair valuation, and he listed the things which he said I'd miss. And I said, "Fine, let's take your narrative," because basically here's a narrative that I told. How many of you have used Uber? Right? So that actually is an indication. One sign of Uber is if you're 30 and below, and you ask how many of you have used Uber, a lot of hands go up. If you ask the same question of 50 and above, it's a much smaller market share. So it's a nature of a disruptive technology. So in my valuation of Uber, here's the story I told. My story about Uber is it's an urban car service company that's going to become a big part of car service globally, but not a dominant part. And here's the reason I kind of built that story. I said it's a car service company. I'm familiar with all the other stories told about Uber becoming a logistics company or a transportation company. It'll replace cars at one stage. But to me, those are now more in the realm of it's possible, but it's not quite made the shift into plausible. In fact, I'm going to use these three words repeatedly through this class. Probable is what you can bring into the numbers. Plausible is you can also think about how you could make this. Possible is the weakest link because you're saying it can happen, it might happen. So I thought that there were lots of possible stories you could tell about Uber, but this seemed to be the probable story. So I described it as a car service company. I saw it primarily as an urban car service company because I didn't see it kind of exploding in suburbia because the kinds of factors that make it so attractive in cities don't quite exist in suburbia yet. And the reason I said it will not get a dominant market share is I didn't see any networking stories. You know the networking stories. The bigger you get, the easier it gets for you to grow. So in online, if you have a search engine, the reason people go on Google is because everybody else is on Google. If you are eBay, the reason people list on eBay is because that's where people are. So there's a networking effect, which means that if you get to a 20% market share, your growth gets easier rather than more difficult. The networking stories for Uber seem to be fairly weak, which is I can see how it can come to dominate a city. But I don't see the fact that it's the biggest car service company in New York helping me if I'm getting off in Jakarta and say, which car service do I want to use? So because of that, I gave it a 10% market share of the global taxi market, and I valued it on that basis. Value I got was about $6 to $7 billion. Now, Bill Gurley's story was different. He said, no, no, that's not what we are. We're not a car service company. We're effectively a company anytime somebody needs transportation. In fact, it was even broader. It's a logistics company. You know what the essence of a logistics company is? Every time you have to move a thing or a person from point A to point B, we're going to be there. Whether it's ice cream in London or a person from Las Vegas to LA, we're going to be there, which already expands the potential market, right? So instead of being a $100 billion market, you're talking about a $1 trillion market. And he said there are networking effects we see, which is you have that app on the phone, you're in Jakarta, the app's already there, you're not going to be looking for something else. And we have connections with credit card companies. It's going to make it easier for you to do this globally. So I said that story is plausible. And in fact, I took his narrative and put it into my Excel spreadsheet, which is pretty flexible. And I came up with a value of $54 billion. You're saying, same company, what, $6 billion or $54 billion? Depending on the narrative you buy into, Uber is cheap at $17 billion, which is the value that it was priced at in the latest venture capital round, or expensive. This is not about the models. It's about the narrative. And the key here, when you think about valuing a company, is what is your narrative about the company you value? So let's start with some misconceptions about valuation. As I said, there is this misconception, very broadly held, that valuation is an objective search for the truth, that you're some kind of scientist sitting there crunching through numbers, that there's no bias in this process. You know what feeds into this? The fact that you feed numbers into a spreadsheet. After a while, you tell, these are only numbers. There's no bias here. I'm not bringing in any viewpoint into this valuation. Dispense with that thought. There are no unbiased valuations. All valuations are biased. The question is, in which direction and by how much? And here's why. I have asked you to pick a company to value, right? And hopefully you're already starting to think about a company to value. Think about how you pick that company. You pick a company not randomly. You pick a company because you've heard about it, you like it, you've read about it. I mean, you already have some preconceptions about the company you're valuing, right? In fact, right after you pick a company, I'd like you to send me an email with what you think you're going to find in your valuation. Sounds odd, right? Just tell me. What do you think your gut tells you? You picked a company, let's say you picked Google. Do you think you're going to find the company to be undervalued, overvalued? And I'm serious, send me the email about, I'm going to create a spreadsheet with your, let's make it, in fact, I'll create a Google shared spreadsheet where after you pick your company, you tell me what you think you're going to find. At the end of the class, let's see what you actually find and let's do a correlation. Know what we're going to find? That what you expected to find and what you actually find match up most of the time. You think that's terrible. It's reality. You don't value a company with a blank slate. You have priors about the company that are going to find their way into your valuation. I'll give you a personal example. I valued Microsoft every year since 1986. That's the year of their IPO. Every single time I valued Microsoft, I found it to be overvalued. You name the price, overvalued. $2, $4, don't buy it, don't buy it, don't buy it, don't buy it. Terrible stock. Odd, right? One of the great success stories, at least of the last part of the last century, I wouldn't have touched it one step of the way. I could give you access to every single valuation I've done of Microsoft, and you could dig through the numbers looking for clues as to why I found it overvalued, but you'd be looking in the wrong place. If you really want to know why I found Microsoft to be overvalued, all you need to do is take an elevator up to the 9th floor, walk to 996, which is my office, open the door, it's actually open. Take whatever you want, and don't do that. But just look around. You'll see enough radiation in that room to kill a person. So there are five computers there. One of them is actually not used. It's sitting on top of my filing cabinet. It's a Mac 128K. For those of you who don't remember, that's the original Mac, which came without a hard drive that you had to swap. You had to actually swap the disk. So you'd put the program disk in, then you'd make a file, and then you put another disk in to save it, then you'd swap it out. Okay. I'm a Mac user. To me, Microsoft has always been the Darth Vader of technology. those of you who are Star Wars fans, let me be specific. I'm not talking Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader, episodes 1, 2, and 3. I'm talking about episodes 4, 5, and 6, Darth Vader, the guy who never takes a shower, you know. I have a lot of bad thoughts about Bill Gates. Anybody who thinks control, alt, delete is a good idea has been hanging around geeks far too long. Right? I have a lot of bad thoughts about Bill Gates, and every time I sit down to value Microsoft, all those bad thoughts come bubbling up to the surface. Because in valuation, you constantly come to forks in the road, low growth or high growth, low risk or high risk, and you get to pick. And guess which one I pick for Microsoft? Low growth or high growth? Who'd buy this rotten product? Low growth. Low risk or high risk, you're one virus away from blowing up. No, high risk. By the time I make my choices, the end game is already set. I am far too biased to value Microsoft. And I know it. But you know what I've also told you, right? I'm far too biased to value... What is my counterpoint to Microsoft? Apple. And I know it. But I've been valuing my Apple every 3 months for the last 5 years. On my blog. In fact, the first valuation of Apple was in, I think, September of 2010. Take a look at that valuation. I spent half the blog post telling people not to trust my valuation. They said, don't trust this valuation. I love the company too much. And I want you to know that when you look at my valuation. And that's all you really can do. You cannot make bias go away. But at least you can be open with yourselves, maybe not even with your clients. Maybe write it in secret. Don't even write it, actually, now that I tell you it might be subpoenaed. Think about it in secret. I don't think they can subpoena your brain. Okay? Be honest with yourself about what you think. In fact, when you sit down and pick the company you did, write down what you think about the company before you look at the numbers, before you look at the valuation. John?
So if the bias exists and you know that going in, why don't you just proactively sort of correct your number up or down, depending?
It's a good question. If the bias exists and you know it going in, how does it help you? In statistics, there's an area of statistics called Bayesian statistics. Have you heard of this? In Bayesian statistics, here's what you're required to do. You're required to state your priors before you run a test or a study. So you're supposed to say, this is what I expect to find my regression. Here's my regression. Most of the time, what you expect to find and what you find converge. But maybe 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 15 times, here's what happens. You expect to find something, and you find something different. And in Bayesian statistics, those are the findings that resonate the most, that actually you act on the most. So it's true, I am biased in Apple, but that, in spite of the bias, to me, Apple actually came out as overvalued in September or June of 2000. And I said, that's scary. I'm biased. I know I'm pushing the numbers up, but even with my biased up numbers, the stock looks over. That's what you're looking for, is those moments where your bias is pushing one direction, but the data tells you, hey, that doesn't make sense. So that's why I think we need to be honest about our biases, because it helps us make our judgments a little more carefully, not be driven purely by bias. Okay? So that's the first rule, is recognize as a bias, be open about it. Let me follow up on that proposition. You tell me who pays you to do a valuation and how much you get paid, I'll tell you which direction the bias is and how much the bias is. And I'll tell you a story to bring this home. So about 20 years ago, a company called Lynn Cable, I don't even know what it's called now, whether it even exists, and AT&T had this option to buy 49% of Lynn Cable at an appraised value. So that's the way the option was actually written. So the time for the option to be exercised comes about. AT&T goes out and hires Morgan Stanley. So you guys are going to be Morgan Stanley. You're assessing the value of Lynn Cable so I can buy 49% at that appraised value. So you work for the buyer. Lynn Cable hires Lehman Brothers. I'm sorry to do this to you, but think of yourselves as pre-bankrupt Lehman Brothers. And you're appraising the value of the same 49% for the seller. So you work for the seller, you work for the buyer, same company, same point in time, same financials. Two investment banking teams, two valuation teams go to work. They come back with two very different numbers. One team comes back with $105 per share. The other comes back with $155 per share. Now I'm going to ask you to guess. Which side came back with which number? Who do you think came back with $105 per share? They did, and why? Because they worked for the buyer. They did their job, they came in with a low ball number. You did your job, you came in with a high ball number. In fact, the difference was so large, they decided to call in a third investment banker. Why settle for two fees when you could have three, I guess? And they call in this outfit called Wasserstein Perella. I'm going to say something incredibly harsh about these guys, but I mean every word of it. These guys couldn't value a $20 bill in a brown paper bag if you put it in front of them. I'm not kidding. Single-handedly, this outfit brought down the practice of valuation about six notches. They'd have invented some multiple, enterprise value to cash in the bag, 3.3. Next thing you know, you'd be paying $66 for a $20 bill. But if you're Wasserstein Perella, you're right in the middle here, right? You want to piss off either side too much. You want to work with both sides in the future. 105, 155, where's the safest place for you to be? 130, right? They came back with $127.50. I'm going to let you in a little secret in valuation. Don't let it out of this room. If you're ever asked to value something, never, ever come back with a nice round number. Ever. Don't tell me the target price is $40. Tell me it's $38.87. It's amazing what that second decimal will do in terms of creating an illusion that you actually know what you're doing. When in doubt, add decimals. The intimidation factor is overwhelming. You can actually make the whole page one column, because in Excel you can have 85 decimals. People say, oh, I'm not asking this guy questions. He's got the 85th decimal nailed down. On the other side of the table, if you see a lot of decimals, you know what it's saying, right? The guy has no idea what the value is. He's just making decimals to intimidate you. So on both sides of the table, there's a story to be told about how many decimals there are in your value. Yes, Sandeep.
The third firm, who got them in, like the buyer or the seller?
Well, it's a mutual society, which is, you know, in this case, I think part of it for legal jeopardy reasons, you've got to kind of bring the two together. So I wouldn't be surprised if a court ordered a third appraiser into the process to kind of split the difference. Okay? So again, you know the transaction is going to happen. The question is what the price is and who plays a role in setting that price. This actually played out a couple of years ago. Last year when Chrysler was trying to get a value attached to it and you had these big differences in value between 1 and 5 billion and depending on which side was doing it, they split the difference. Okay? It's one reason why I think valuations in legal settings, because this is what they do. They take two numbers, no matter how extreme, and they split the difference. So guess what they do? They push both sides to further and further extremes, because if you know they're going to split the difference, why would you ever want to come up with a reasonable value? Because if you come up with a reasonable value and the other side doesn't, you're screwed. So it actually undercuts the whole notion of we want experts to appraise the value fairly. If you're going to split the difference, that's never going to happen. So first step in valuation is recognizing that bias is everywhere. Don't bitch about it. Don't mourn about it. Just recognize it's there. Because when you look at a valuation, here are the two questions you need to ask. Who did this valuation? Who paid them to do the valuation? Because once you answer the two questions, the rest is going to follow. You can see why they're doing what they're doing. Okay? So as you watch the Alibaba Roadshow, remember the bankers who are putting a value out have a selling job ahead of them, right? This is a sales pitch. It's not a valuation. So what you're going to see as numbers essentially will back up that sales pitch. Nothing wrong with it as long as both sides recognize that's exactly what's going on. So that's the first thing. Bias in valuation is everywhere. At least be honest about it. And the more biased the process, the more pointless the valuation becomes. Because if you push in enough bias in the process towards one side, why even waste your time? In fact, in acquisitions, I have a very simple rule. Let's dismiss all M&A teams and say the value of a target company is whatever you've chosen to pay for it plus $10. Because that's effectively where you're going to end up, right? You're going to grind out the numbers and say, hey, you know what? The value of this target company is whatever you decide to pay for it plus $10. Why go through this charade if you've already decided that? Second misconception about valuation. If I do a good valuation, I'm going to get the right answer. When does this get started? Probably when around the age of 5 or 6. You go off to school. The teacher puts a sheet of paper in front of you. 2 plus 3. You get 5. Congratulations. You got the right answer. You must have done everything right. You get any other answer, in case you're still wondering what 2 plus 3 is. You're too much of a story person even for this class. No. But you get any other answer, what's the reaction you get from the teacher? You got the wrong answer. You must have done something wrong. Count your fingers. Whatever it is, get it right. And this gets drummed into you all the way through school, right? If you do things right, you get the right answer. If you got the wrong answer, you must have done something wrong. And God help you if you become an engineer or a scientist or a mathematician, because then you get 4 or 5 more years of input-output. You get the inputs right, the output should be right. How many of you are engineers, recovering engineers, or whatever the right term is? Good. I don't know whether this is going to continue for the rest of the class. Hopefully not, no? I think actually the more quantitative your background, the more difficulty you have in valuation. Because you're so, it's so ingrained in you. If I do things right, I should get the right answer. Yeah. Because in valuation, that doesn't hold. That's why it's not a science. All valuations are imprecise. In fact, in the 28 years I've taught the class, somewhere in the 11th or the 12th session, now, this is the 11th or the 12th week. I usually get about 15 or 20 people come into my office. Not all at the same time. I have a really small office. Okay? But around the same time. And most of them will be engineers or mathematicians, or, you know, some kind of quant background. They'll come in and put a valuation down on my desk. I'm done with my valuation. Could you take a look and tell me whether I got the right answer? I don't even take a look. I push it back to them and say, I don't know what the right answer is. And you can see the faith in the system start to crack. So you're teaching this class, you don't know what the right answer is? To which my response is, if I knew what the right value for every company was, why would I be teaching this class? Right? I'd have my own island in Hawaii with Larry Ellison with a castle on top of it. Right? And you can see the group splinter at this stage. Half the group cannot handle the fact that there is no right answer. So you know what happens to them? They become fixed income people. I mean, let's face it. It's so much more comfortable sitting there with a bond, right? The maturity is given, the coupon is given. I know you have to worry about default risk, but it's all in the denominator. Don't worry about margins and growth and all that stuff. Doesn't even matter. And I let them go. It's actually a very healthy recognition early in the process that this is not for you, because you can't handle not knowing what the right answer is. The other half says, this is kind of fun. If you don't know what the right answer is, I can never, ever conclusively be wrong. Think about it. It's one of the great things about valuing equities. You can never, ever conclusively be wrong. You pick a stock, it goes on 31 years in a row. You know what you tell me? Not a long enough time horizon. It went bankrupt. The system got in the way. That Lehman buy you put out in 2007, we're looking really good right now. If only the company hadn't gone bankrupt. I think it's a lot of fun not knowing what the right answer is. But it does make people uncomfortable. And here's what's going to show up. When you're finished with your discounted cash flow valuation, you're going to look at the number and say, is that right? And you know what the answer to that is? I don't know. Nobody does, and you have to be okay with it. A lot of valuation is being okay with that psychological non-closure at the end of the valuation of something you can check that number off. In fact, I'll give you one of the great ironies in valuation. The more uncertain you feel about that final number, the greater the payoff to doing valuation. That sound weird? We take 2 companies for you. The first company is Coca-Cola. So you guys are going to value Coca-Cola, and you guys are going to value Twitter. Who's got the easier job? Coca-Cola. You know exactly what they do, right? The margins are stable. They might have a little tweaking to do. You can take historical data. This is training the street valuation. Basically, you can take each line item, project out the line items. They all add up. You'll end up with a model, which gives you a pretty reasonable estimate of value. So you think, this is good. Your job is like going through hell, right? You don't know what business they'll be in, whether the margins will come because they're losing money, whether they'll survive, whether Facebook will take them over, all this stuff rolling around. So when you're done with the evaluation, you're going to feel incredibly uncertain, much more uncertain than they did. See, this is easy. Let me stick with valuing Coca-Cola. The way to think about uncertainty is not how uncertain you feel about valuing a company relative to valuing other companies, but how uncertain you feel about valuing the company relative to other people valuing the same company. You see the contrast? Anybody can value Coca-Cola precisely. And by anybody, I mean a 12-year-old could value Coca-Cola precisely. You give me a bunch of reasonably bright 12-year-olds, I can teach them enough valuation to value Coca-Cola in about an hour. There's nothing much there. In fact, I don't even probably need a body in the middle. I can probably create a spreadsheet or an app to do the valuation of Coca-Cola. I really don't need you. So thank God every company is not Coca-Cola. In contrast, in valuing Twitter, I have to make lots of judgments. And be happy that you have to make lots of judgments, because that's why I need you. And the reality is, you feel uncertain about valuing Twitter. Everybody else feels at least as uncertain, probably even more so than you do. And most people, because they feel uncertain, decide not to value Twitter. They say, it's too uncertain, I'm not valuing Twitter. You know how many people invest in social media companies without ever valuing them? And their argument is, it's too difficult to value them. There's too much uncertainty. You just bought the stock. If you bought the stock, you can't cop out by saying there's too much uncertainty, I can't put a number on it, because you put the ultimate number on it today by paying that price up front. If you choose to invest in a stock, you have to deal with uncertainty. In fact, I'll close with an analogy to illustrate what I'm saying. Let's assume you go to weather forecasting school. I don't know whether there's a school that teaches weather forecasting, but they probably teach you how to have good hair, pointed blank walls, et cetera, right? Because actually that's a big skill in weather forecasting. It used to be that you pointed at a blank wall and you had to get Nevada right. And if you're pointing at Louisiana and saying that's Nevada, you're fired on the spot, right? So you get really good at this. It's time to graduate. And I give you choices of two places you can go to work. The first is Honolulu, Hawaii. The other is Fargo, North Dakota. You think this is easy? You want to be a star weather forecaster. You're saying, what's a star weather forecaster? When that local news comes on, you want it to be just you for 25 minutes, and then the rest of the news for the remaining five. You know why I picked Honolulu and Fargo, North Dakota? Honolulu, Hawaii has the least variable temperature in the country, in the United States, and the most predictable weather. Yesterday was a dry day. There's a 97% chance that tomorrow is going to be dry. If yesterday rained, so in a sense, it's extra. So tomorrow in Honolulu, it's going to be 83 degrees and sunny. I have no idea, but I think I'm going to be pretty close, even without looking at the newspaper. Fargo, North Dakota, has the most variable temperature in the country in terms of day-to-day shifts in temperature and day-to-day shifts from dry to wet weather. Now think of what you want to be. You want to be a star weather forecaster, right? You go to Honolulu, Hawaii, you're probably not even going to get on the news. Why? Because everybody knows tomorrow's going to be 83 and sunny. What the heck are you going to tell them? Tomorrow's going to be 83 and sunny. I knew that already. Fargo, North Dakota, you are the news. Russia, Ukraine, that'll come at the 28th minute of the news. For the first 27 minutes, it's going to be, there's going to be a snowstorm coming, and you get to dumb. It's like being in New York last winter, right? Remember those local news stories that come in like December and January? The only news you heard about was the next snowstorm coming, and the weather forecaster was front and center. That's a way to think about valuation. You want to make a difference, go where it's darkest. And that's exactly the way I described it. Go where people are most uncertain, because that's where the payoff to doing valuation is greatest. So bias, uncertainty. There's a third factor to keep in mind. And this is, again, a misconception that I think has become even bigger over time. If I build a bigger model, it's going to get better. It's so easy to build big models now, right? You have Excel spreadsheets, you can add inputs, you have build macros, inputs come in, they never leave, and God help you if there's a team in the basement of your business building valuation models for you. It's the geek squad. They come in, they always get sent to the basement. Don't ask me why, they're not supposed to see the light or whatever it is, and they love building models. The model starts with 15 inputs, and before you know it, you need 85 inputs to value one company. Two things happen to these models. One is what I call input fatigue. You know what input fatigue is? I'll describe it to you. If you've ever worked in an investment bank, it's going to sound very, very familiar. It'll probably hit you around 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. You've been working all day, all week. In fact, you've been working all year. Finally done. You get ready to turn off your computer, put everything away, go home. Your managing director shows up and says, puts a 10K on your desk. I want this company valued on my desk first thing tomorrow morning. Why? Sunday morning, it's a trial by fire. You want to see how much you really want your job. Part of you wants to exercise your option to abandon. I won't describe it. It's deeply satisfying when you exercise it. Usually it takes the form of throwing the 10K back in your managing director's face. You do it yourself. That's a deeply satisfying moment. When it leaves your hand, everything after that is a little bit downhill. Right? So you think about it, but then you pull it back. The car, the house, the apartment, the girlfriend, the boyfriend, whatever it is, all the expenses that have accumulated for you. And you sit down to value the company with your in-house model, which has 85 inputs in it. So you start entering the numbers very carefully, just like you've been taught in valuation class. You get to the 10th input, the clock strikes midnight. You're not Cinderella. You wish you were. You look down, there are 75 more inputs to go. Your stomach drops. You look at the 11th input and say, what was the inventory 5 years ago? Part of you wants to go look it up, but that part's too exhausted to get out of the chair. The other part says, enter a random number. Let's move on. It's amazing how quickly the random numbers roll out. And the scary thing is the output comes out. It all looks the same. That input you spent 3 hours over, the input that you spent 3 seconds over, all meld together. And here's another little secret in valuation that you shouldn't let out of this room. If you have a valuation with a lot of random number inputs, here's how you hide it. Create more detail in your output. Have 35 pages and 500 line items. Nobody will have any idea what's random and what's not. Which means if you're on the other side of the table and somebody gives you a valuation that runs 35 pages, don't even look at it. Push it back and say, what are you trying to hide from me? Good valuations should be parsimonious. Less is more. It's something I'll keep repeating. When you're in doubt about whether you should add more detail, always ask yourself the question, do I have the information to kind of get a better estimate of value with this level of detail? I'll give you one example we're going to run into repeatedly in this class. One of the items you need to get to cash flow is change in working capital. That's how to get from earnings to cash flows, right? And if you remember your accounting, what goes into working capital? All kinds of crap, right? You got inventory, accounts receivable, cash, you got other current assets, you got accounts payable, deferred this, deferred that. So you could break working capital down into what, 15 line items? I have never in my life ever done a valuation with working capital broken down. And here's why. Maybe you can do this, but I've never been able to forecast number of days of inventory in the year 2028. If you have that power, be my guest, break things down. But if you don't, what's the point? And the more uncertain you feel, the less detail you should have. So that's input fatigue. The second is when you build these really elaborate models, you end up with black boxes. You know what I mean by black boxes? You have a model. You feed numbers in, something happens, a number pops out on the other side. You say, I didn't value the company. The model valued the company. You're welcome to download any of the spreadsheets I have on my website to do your valuation on one condition. I don't want to see these words in your final report. The De Modern model valued the company at. Because you know what you're trying to do is shunt off the responsibility on me. It's your fault. I just used your model. If I get a strange number, if you use my model, make it yours. It's a spreadsheet. You want to tweak it? Go ahead. If you have no idea what's going on, pick something else. Okay? So again, it's something we struggle with, and it's getting more difficult over time because it's easier to build more complex models, and the data gets more complex. You're tempted to keep building in more and more detail until it breaks you down. So I call this the Bermuda Triangle of valuation. Those of you who remember the history of the Bermuda Triangle, it's this mythical place. I don't think it really exists, but somewhere in the Atlantic, there's supposedly this triangle in the in area right in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, where ships and planes go in and disappear. See, that's the story. We're going to take that story as a given, and there is an equivalent Bermuda Triangle in valuation where good sense goes in but doesn't come out. Okay? And the reason for that are the three things we talked about. There's bias, there's uncertainty, and there's complexity. Because as human beings, all three get in the way of doing good valuation. Because with bias comes denial. What bias? I'm not biased. In fact, you look at every one of these valuation certificates, you know, whether it's a CFA or NACFA or whatever it is, as part of the thing that they give you, as they're part of the objective, they say, we're unbiased. We turn out objective valuations. That's a denial. There's a lot of deception, which is you try to hide the bias behind the numbers, saying, well, I don't know, it's not there. And of course, you complete the process by deluding yourself by saying, hey, I wasn't biased, I was just using the numbers. With uncertainty, Standard reactions is when you face a lot of uncertainty, you stop even making estimates. You stop even trying. Or you outsource. You say, well, I can't deal with it. Let me let somebody else do it. Let McKinsey do it. Let Goldman Sachs do it. Let me come up with a number from outside, because that way, if something goes wrong, I can blame somebody else. And with complexity, as you said, you can build these really big models. And after a while, the model starts to become the story. And the reality is, I think people build complex models, again, to intimidate. Because if you're a banker and you're presenting a valuation, think of how much more intimidating it is to have a complex model where nobody has any idea, including you, of what's going on. I believe that the biggest reason for bad valuations is not that people don't get valuation first principles. I'm going to argue that valuation is simple. It's how we deal with the bias, the uncertainty, and the complexity that gets us into trouble. In a couple of weeks, I'm supposed to go in and talk to a bunch of M&A bankers at an investment bank. And when the person in charge of M&A at that investment bank called me, you know, she said, no, I'd like you to come in and talk to our bankers about doing valuation right. And I said, it's useless. And she said, what? You know, we have smart bankers. They've learned. I said, it's nothing to do with how smart your bankers are or whether they get the stuff. It's useless because the process is too biased to create good valuations. And think about it. You're a banker and I'm a potential acquirer. I come to you with a question. Should I do this deal? Give me the two possible answers. Yes or no, right? If you say no, what do you get?
Nothing.
The undying gratitude of my stockholders, but try paying bonuses with that. If you say yes, you make $100 million. I've used this analogy before, might as well use it again. Asking a banker whether a deal makes sense is like asking a plastic surgeon whether there's something wrong with your face. What kind of answer are you going to get? You're perfect already? That's, I think, part of the process. That until we're honest about the bias, we can talk about tweaking models and doing things right, but it's pointless because the bias is going to override everything else. So keep that in mind as we go through, because I think if you can be honest with yourself about those three things, you're going to be much better at doing valuation. So let's set the table here on the different ways in which you can do valuation. I'm going to spend about 20 minutes setting the table here, because we're going to come back and talk about these in more detail. I told you the three ways to do valuation. Let's start with intrinsic valuation, where the value of a business is based on its specifics, its cash flows, its growth, its risk. We're going to spend half the class on that, but that's not the only way to do valuation. I told you that most of what passes for valuation out there is pricing, where you price something based on how other assets that are priced out there are being priced. That's relative valuation. And usually you'd see it take the form of multiples and comparables, a P/E ratio in these 15 companies in the context of valuation. Or there's contingent claim valuation. Every valuation model you see out there has to fall into one of these three buckets. And I'd at least like to set the table on what these three approaches assume about the world and why you might pick one over the other. And I'm not going to push you as to this one is the better one. It's a choice you have to make. But before you do any of these, if you're an investor using valuation, you're already telling me something about what you think about efficient markets, right? How many of you believe markets are efficient? Good, because if you did, then I'd say, why are you wasting your time in this class? Because if we believed in efficient markets, what's the best estimate of value for any company? Is open up the newspaper, look up the price, you're done, right? So almost, whether it's true or not, the fact that we're sitting down to do valuation suggests that we think markets make mistakes, that markets are inefficient. Each of these approaches makes a different judgment about how markets make mistakes and how they correct their mistakes. And I'm going to argue that you need to think about both, right? Because you don't make money on market mistakes. You make money on markets correcting their mistakes. You have to make assumptions about both of those. And every single one of these approaches makes different assumptions. So one thing I'd like to do is talk about what those implied assumptions are in each approach. And as I describe them, start thinking about it already in terms of which one do you feel best reflects your views of markets and how they operate. So let's start with intrinsic valuation. What is it? Very simply put, an intrinsic valuation, the value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows in that asset. Most of you took foundations a year ago, right? Somewhere very early in the foundations class, you started talking about present value. And you started wearing out that button on your calculator, the PV button. And there's a reason for that. 80% of what we do in finance is time value of money, it's present value. Because the rest of the class was about how to get the cash flows better and how to come up with the right discount rate. Discounted cash flow valuation, the value of an asset, is the present value of the expected cash flows of the asset. Philosophically, here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to estimate the intrinsic value of a company, of an asset. Does it exist? There are people who believe there is no such thing as intrinsic value. In fact, I've had long arguments with analysts who contend that this intrinsic value stuff is a mirage. It doesn't exist. I can't prove that it does. In fact, I believe that every asset has an intrinsic value. Every company has an intrinsic value. But I also firmly believe that I'll never get to see it. So intrinsic valuation is a little bit like the search for the Holy Grail. The fun is in the looking, but you're never going to find it. And you've got to be okay with it. So when you do intrinsic valuation, you're saying, I want to get the intrinsic value of an asset, even though I get no confirmation that I got it right. And if you break down a discounted cash flow value model down, here are the three ingredients you're going to see. You're going to see a life for the asset that you're valuing, right? 10 years, 15 years, 50 years, forever. You're going to see cash flows over that life and a discount rate that goes with those cash flows. You can make this more complicated than you have to, but that's basically what you're going to see. And if you can give me those three ingredients, I can value just about anything, whether it's an Arian Foster tracking stock, the hot dog stand outside, or Coca-Cola. It's all variations of the same thing. But now let's ask the interesting question. I don't know about you, but I don't do valuation because I'm intellectually curious. I don't lie awake at night think, I wonder what Alibaba is worth right now. Maybe you do, but if you do, see somebody really quickly about this. This is not good, right? I do valuation for one reason and one reason alone, because I'm greedy. I want to make money off my valuations. So let's see what the assumptions have to be for you to actually make money off your valuations. First, you have to assume that markets make mistakes, right? You know what? You're probably not going to find a single person in the world who disagrees with that assumption. Even the firmest believer in efficient markets will concede that markets make mistakes and some doozies. Second, you have to assume that you can find those mistakes with your metrics and models. Now we're on dangerous ground, right? Why? What's the track record of people who claim to find market mistakes? Let me rephrase that question. How much does the average active portfolio manager beat the S&P 500 by each year? That's a trick question. I wish it were zero. The average active portfolio manager delivers between 1% and 1.5% less than whatever index you pick for that portfolio manager in every part of the market, in every part of the world. It's the strangest profession. Can you imagine any other profession structured the way this is? It wouldn't work, right? But let's say you're special. You actually have a metric or model that actually works. You found a mistake. Let's give the mistake a name. Let's call it Cisco. Stock's trading at, what, 28 or something? It's been trading at 28 for the last decade. You think it's worth 40. Let's say you're right. It should really be trading at 40. The market's made a mistake. You go buy 1 million shares of Cisco at 28. Have you made any money yet? What's the third assumption that has to happen here? Markets have to, David, markets have to correct their mistakes, and the 28 has to go to 40. So how do you make it do that? You found a market mistake. You were right, there was a market mistake. How do you get the market to correct its mistakes? You can go on the Yahoo message board and keep posting, Cisco's cheap, Cisco's cheap, Cisco's cheap, buy it now. Nobody's listening to you. The third leg is not within your control. And that's frustrating, because you can be right and go bankrupt being right. Your neighbor can buy stocks based on astrological signs and make billions of dollars. There's no justice in the world. So don't expect affirmation just because you've done your job that the market will somehow say, oh, you worked really hard in your intrinsic valuation, you have a 25% return. You have to be okay with the fact that you can be right and not make any money, and other people can be horribly wrong and make lots of money. It's the way markets are. So I'm going to use that as my structure for thinking about when discounted cash flow valuation works and when it doesn't, what its advantages and disadvantages are. Here are the biggest advantages of discounted cash flow valuation. First, because you're valuing a company based on fundamentals, you're not exposed to market moods and what they think about sectors or companies. you're going to see that the advantages actually become disadvantages as well. So basically, first thing in intrinsic valuation, if I ask you to do an intrinsic valuation of a social media company, I don't care what it is, you're going to base it on the cash flows, the risk, and the growth, and you're going to come up with the value. The fact that everybody thinks social media is second coming doesn't show up in your valuation because it's not in your cash flows. Second, the old adage that Warren Buffett put out, which is you never buy stock in a company, you buy a piece of a business. If you truly believe that, then you really should be doing intrinsic valuation because you're trying to value the business, not a stock or an investment or something traded out there. So intrinsic valuation, if you believe that notion of buying a business, is exactly how you should think about investing. Third, whether you like it or not, if you truly want to do a good intrinsic valuation, you have to understand the business, its competitors, the sector, the growth. It forces you to get your hands dirty, understanding the details of the company. And finally, if you truly do a valuation and you stick with it, you're kind of immunized from what the rest. In other words, you don't care what the lemmings do. They can go into the ocean, they can do whatever they want. You're investing based on cash flows, growth, and risk. You're kind of immunized from market shifts in mood and momentum. So those are the advantages. Here are the disadvantages. It does take a lot more work to do a discounted cash flow valuation than appraising. Anybody can slap an average PE ratio on earnings and come up with value. It takes a little more work. Okay? Second, for better or worse, a lot of what passes for discounted cash flow valuation doesn't pass the smell test. A lot of first principles get violated. It looks like a DCF valuation. We're going to talk a lot about charades that pass for DCF valuation, things that people get away with. But the reality is discounted cash flow valuations can range the spectrum from really good valuations to abysmally bad valuations. There are some DCFs where I say, why did you even waste your time doing this? Why don't you just apply a PE ratio to the earnings? It'll be a much cleaner, much more honest way of coming up with the answer. Third, because of the fact that you are getting an intrinsic value for a company, there is no guarantee that anything is going to look cheap or expensive. You could find every stock in a sector to be overvalued. So you could take every social media company and say, don't buy any of those companies. You could find an entire market to be overvalued, every single stock. In which case, if you're an equity portfolio manager, what should you do? Do what Warren Buffett did in 1969, which is shut the fund down, return the cash back to the investor saying, I can't find anything that meets my criteria. Try that if you're a Fidelity manager. Send all the money back, then go to your boss and say, you know what, I liquidated the fund. I can't find anything to invest in. Most of us don't have that control. But that's where intrinsic value will take you. There'll be points in time when nothing will look cheap, and you have to do the sensible thing and say, nothing looks cheap, I'm buying nothing. That's very, very difficult to do. If your job is to be invested in equities, if you're a portfolio manager. So here's when discounted cash flow valuation works best. First, it works best on cash flow generating assets. You say, as opposed to what? Faster to value Bitcoin? You can't value it using a discounted cash flow model. If I ask you to value gold, you can't value it using a discounted cash flow model. If I ask you to value Picasso, you can't value it using a discounted cash flow model. Those have to be priced. So there are some assets where you cannot do intrinsic valuation. That's fine. You have to recognize that that's the case. And if you are looking at assets that generate cash flows, whether you should use discounted cash flow valuation will depend on the following. First, it'll depend on your time horizon. You know why? What did I say the third assumption you needed was markets have to correct their mistakes, right? I can't guarantee you this, but the longer your time horizon, the more time you give markets to correct their mistakes, assuming you were right in the first place, the greater the chance that they'll correct the mistakes. So if you have a 5-year or a 10-year time horizon on Cisco, there's a greater chance, assuming that your value was right, that the price will move towards its value. If you have a 3 or a 6-month time horizon, don't even waste your time. You're not giving the market enough time to correct its mistakes. So the longer your time horizon, the better candidate you are for intrinsic valuation. So start thinking about these issues because, again, I can't imprint this on you. If I asked you how many of you have long time horizons, I'll wager most of us will put up our hands because that's what we're supposed to have, right? So speculative guys who have short time horizons. Then I ask you a different question. When your portfolio goes down, do you feel impatient? Do you feel uncomfortable? And you say yes, then you have an internal problem, right? Because you tell me you have a long time horizon, but every fiber of your being says, sell now, get out now, because the stock is moving in the wrong direction. You control your time horizon only partially. Some of it comes from external factors, which is how much do you need the cash. Some of it you're just born with. So if you have a long time horizon, that's better than if you have a short time horizon. Second, if you can provide the catalyst for the market correction, that's even better, right? What am I talking about? If you're a Carl Icahn or a Bill Ackman, if you buy something that's cheap, what do you do next? Make a pest of yourself, right? You get to the Wall Street Journal and CNBC, you're everywhere. Why? Because you hope to move the price towards a value. So you and I on the Yahoo message board can do nothing, but a Bill Ackman or a Carl Icahn can provide the catalyst that moves the price. So an activist investor has an advantage when it comes to intrinsic valuation. A private equity investor like KKR or Blackstone has advantage because they can lay claim on the cash flows. And third, you have to be able to be, if you tell me as a kid that you are susceptible to peer pressure, you know what I'm talking about? You're hanging out of the group, everybody else is doing stupid things, you have to do the same stupid thing because you feel you don't want to be. You're probably not suited for intrinsic valuation. Again, there's nothing wrong or right by this, but basically it's a psychological judgment you have to make on yourself. Are you okay being wrong alone? It's very uncomfortable to be the only person buying something when everybody else is selling. Intrinsic valuation might be more suited for you. So make that call for yourself. There's nothing good or bad about intrinsic valuation. You have to know whether it fits you as an investor. Now let's talk a little bit about pricing. In relative valuation, you've given up on the notion of intrinsic value. You value an asset based on how similar assets are priced out there. Here are the three ingredients of a relative valuation. First, you need to tell me what your similar assets are, right? So if I ask you to value Alibaba on a relative basis, what are you looking for? Other companies that you could compare Alibaba to? You might say, well, Baidu is set up similarly to Alibaba. It's a Chinese online company. It's a variable interest entity. That's my comparable. It's one company. Or you can say it's online advertising companies or online retail companies or all online companies or social media companies. You can see there's a subjective component to it, but that's the first step, is coming up with a group of comparable. Second, recognizing you can't compare price per share across companies. Why not? If I use price per share as my measure of what's expensive and what's cheap, Berkshire Hathaway is the most expensive stock in the market, and penny stocks look really cheap, right? You can't use prices because prices are, in a sense, arbitrary. Arbitrary in the sense that Apple's stock price 2 months ago was $600. Today it's $100. What am I missing though, in the middle? There's a 7-for-1 stock split. The price per share reflects the units you have in the company, and that could be made larger or smaller through arbitrary actions. That's why we divide the price per share or the market value by something. See where I'm going next? You divide price by earnings, price by book, EV by EBITDA. You're coming up with a scale price that you hope you can compare across these companies. And then you realize, if you're careful, that you got Alibaba's EV to EBITDA, and you got the EV to EBITDA for these 20 other companies that you call similar to Alibaba. And then you recognize that Alibaba has better margins or higher growth or less risk. You've got to control for those differences. Come up with comparables, standardize the price, control for differences. That's the essence of relative valuation. And when you're doing it, what are you assuming about markets? Remember, you're comparing across those 15 companies. You're assuming on average markets get things right, right? When you do relative valuation, that's what you're assuming. But that they're wrong in individual companies. You're saying on average markets are right about social media companies, but they might be mispricing individual stocks. And for you to make money, that mispricing has to disappear. One of the advantages you have with relative valuation is if you have a stock that is mispriced relative to the sector, it stands out, right? So if you have a stock trading at 8x earnings in a sector where everything else trades at 25, it's much more noticeable than a stock that's undervalued on an intrinsic value basis. So market mistakes, if they exist on a relative basis, get corrected much more quickly. Now do you see why the time horizon issue came up? If your time horizon is 3 months or 6 months, you can see why relative valuation is going to be a weapon of choice, not intrinsic valuation. So here are the advantages of relative valuation, in the sense of the flip side of intrinsic valuation. First, in relative valuation, you're far more likely to come up with a number that's in sync with the market. Why? Because it's almost circular, right? Because if you use the price-earnings ratios of companies to back into a price for your stock, you're far more likely to come up with a number closer to what you see the current price to be. And that can be an advantage if your job is to be an equity portfolio manager or an IPO banker or a transactor, is you have to come up with a number that reflects the market as it exists today. because you have to transact today. And in relative valuation, almost by definition, you're going to find cheap stocks, no matter what the point in time is, because you're looking at something being cheap or expensive relative to everything else. So you could take social media companies and tell me, you know what? Twitter looks cheap. On a per user basis, you're getting more, I mean, you pay less for Twitter's per user than you do for Facebook. So in relative valuation, you're always going to find something that you can buy or something you can sell. And it requires less information. And I'm going to come back to this. Less explicit information to value a stock on a relative basis than an intrinsic value basis. Sounds strange. You know, what do you mean explicit? I don't have to actually directly estimate a cost of equity or a cost of capital or growth rates or cash flows. I make implicit assumptions. And that's, I think, one of the problems is because the assumptions are implicit, sometimes you don't even think about what you're assuming when you apply 50 times earnings or 30 times revenues to a company. The assumptions get pushed down. And finally, with relative valuation, you're playing what I call the incremental game. What I mean by that, and you're going to see this around the next earnings season, is around the earnings report, you'll see the speculation about what's going to be in that report. In fact, doesn't even there be the earnings season. In about 3 days, Apple is going to announce the new iPhone 6. I don't know the exact day this week. And already the mood is building up, right? And if you're an investor in Apple, if you're a trader in Apple playing the relative valuation game, you don't care about cash flows or growth or what the value looks like right now. All you have to do is guess the content of that report. And if you guess it right, you're going to make money. In other words, if you guess that announcement is going to be a positive surprise, I don't know what the positive would mean, an iPhone the size of a boat or something, no? Then you say, oh, you know what? I'm going to buy the stock today and sell it next week. You're being very concrete about what you're doing. You're playing the incremental information game with relative valuation. That's perfectly okay. And if you think about the disadvantages of relative valuation, when you tell me something is undervalued or overvalued, remember, you're making a relative statement. So if you tell me Twitter is cheap on a relative basis, you're saying it's cheap relative to other social media companies. But guess what? They could all be overvalued, in which case you could buy Twitter and you could lose only 20%. You say, only 20%? If everybody else is losing 50%, you still look like a genius. In relative valuation, you're playing the relative game. You're not telling me something is cheap or expensive. You're saying it's cheap or expensive relative to everything else. Okay? And for portfolio managers, because of the way in which relative valuation gets used, often you forget those implicit assumptions you're making about markets, about companies, about sectors that can come back to bite you. So when does relative valuation work best? First, you need a lot of companies or assets just like yours. That's why relative valuation is so much easier when you're selling real estate, right? If you're a realtor, how do you price a house? You look at other houses in the neighborhood, look at what they sold for. You control for the difference in the number of rooms. So it's much easier to do relative valuation. You have a lot of assets out there. Yesterday was Derek Jeter Day at Yankee Stadium. And on SeatGeek, I went on Saturday to see what the price of tickets were. Relative pricing is trivial because if you look at a section, you can see the other seats in the section. You can see what prices people are asking for it. Relative valuation is trivial when you have a lot of assets out there that are priced and you can compare prices. Relative valuation becomes much more difficult if you don't have a lot of assets out there. So if I ask you to value a price of Picasso, all you need to do is find 50 other Picassos that have sold in the last month and you should be home free, right? And in collectibles, that's often the problem, is the last Picasso might have sold 3 years ago and one Picasso and another Picasso might not quite match up, which is part of the reason Sotheby's can collect 20%. It's probably saying, we're going to appraise your value because it becomes much more difficult to do. So if you then think about, is this right for me? Here are some of the things I want you to think about. Think about your time horizon. The shorter your time horizon, the better candidate you are for relative valuation. So if your time horizon is a day, a week, months, don't do intrinsic valuation. It's pointless. Stick with multiples and comparables. Second, if you're judged on a relative benchmark, you know what I mean by that? How are mutual fund managers judged? Relative to other mutual fund managers. If you lose 20%, are you a bad mutual fund manager? If everybody else lost 30%, you're a good portfolio manager. So if you're judged on a relative basis. And finally, and this is, I think, what hedge funds can bring to the game that gives them an advantage. How do you make money in relative valuation? Is when the mispriced assets move towards the middle, towards what's right? And usually if you're a long-only investor, you can buy only the cheaper assets and hope they move up towards the market and hope that the market overall is correct, right? You see the advantage you have as a hedge fund? You buy your cheaper stocks, you sell short on your overpriced stocks. Even if the entire sector is mispriced, you will still make money because all you need is convergence. So as a hedge fund, you could see why multiples and comparables work better for you because you have both sides available for you to play that game. So intrinsic valuation, relative valuation. I know we're at the end of the session, so let me just close off with one final approach that I didn't describe as a separate approach. And we'll talk a little bit about this, but this is asset-based valuation. You see, what are you talking about? I give you a company to value. Now, normally we value the whole company, but sometimes you'll see people valuing pieces of the company. They'll take each asset and value it separately, then add up the pieces. You'll often see this described as a sum of the parts valuation, right? Basically, you add the parts. So if I ask you to value Disney, you value ESPN, then you value Marvel, then you value Disney Studios, Disney theme parks, you add them all up. Or if you do an accounting valuation where each asset gets a fair value attached, you're valuing the pieces. You're saying, why isn't this a different way of doing valuation? Think about how we come up with the values of ESPN or the value of an asset. We either have to do intrinsic valuation or we have to do relative valuation. Asset-based valuation is not a different valuation approach. It's an application of an existing approach to come up with a different answer. So we'll come back and talk about when it's okay to do asset-based valuation and when your answer should be the same and when they may diverge.
Yeah.